Good afternoon. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm the president of the Independent Institute. I'm delighted to welcome you to our Independent Policy Forum today. As many of you know, the Institute regularly sponsors programs featuring outstanding experts to address major social and economic problems, especially as they may relate to important new books. And today is certainly no exception. Many of you may have seen today's Wall Street Journal editorial page. And of course, the events of recent days certainly are testimony to the issue of race relations in the United States. For those of you new to the Institute, the packet at your seat will give you some background information. The Institute is a nonprofit, non-politicized public policy research organization. We sponsor about 6 to 10 books per year, and we hold many conference and media projects based on the results of this work. Our purpose at the Institute is, I guess could be described as a Jeffersonian one, in not only an interest in the tradition of liberty and the integrity of the individual as far as rights as well as responsibilities, but also as far as the idea of trying to seek truth in public affairs, especially regarding the impact of government policies, and not necessarily just to tell people what they might want to hear. In so doing, we will not take the public pronouncements of government officials at face value, nor the conventional wisdom necessarily, over serious public problems. We invite your involvement, but as a result of such work, often the results are quite challenging and even provocative. We accept no government funding, but we do draw our support from a broad range of foundations, businesses, and individuals, and each of you is welcome to join us as a tax-deductible member. In your packet, you'll find information in reference to that. Members currently are able to obtain a copy of one of our newest books called Beyond Politics, which recently won an award on the issue of the apparent dysfunction and pathology, even, of the way contemporary politics and government policies seem to spin out. Also, in keeping with the subject of our luncheon today and much of the popular media, our most recent book is one that many of you may be interested in. It's a book that just came out called The Diversity Myth. And its subtitle is Multiculturalism and the Politics of Intolerance. Those of you who have had some knowledge or experience at Stanford University will have some knowledge of some of the disputes that have ranged over a number of years there. This particular book has been authored by two recent graduates and is getting quite a bit of attention. Our program today is a special one, and in making the forum possible today, I want to especially thank the members of the host committee who helped to make it possible. A list you'll find on the program, also in your packet. But 30 years, almost exactly 30 years, after the civil rights laws of the 1960s, race may still be the most divisive social issue of our time. Black unemployment, illegitimacy, crime, school dropout rates remain multiple of those for whites. Here in California, Proposition 187's ongoing legal ballot battles and public disputes, Governor Wilson's pledge to abolish affirmative action in state government, the recent decision of the Regents of the University of California over affirmative action, the California Civil Rights Initiative, and of course, the racial disparity over the O.J. Simpson case and verdict attest to the continuing ability of race-related issues to polarize public opinion, to say the least. In contrast to perhaps what was viewed as optimism that followed the civil rights movement of the 60s, many today, I believe, doubt whether it may even be possible to have an America characterized by widespread racial harmony or a melting pot. I believe that's mistaken, but that's an increasing view. Yet despite the prevalence of race-related issues, few agree about the nature of such issues, where they come from, and how best to deal with them. In fact, there seems to be fundamental confusion over exactly what racism may even be. In our policy forum today, we're privileged to have best-selling author Dinesh D'Souza, who's going to address many of these issues and answer your questions. He, of course, is the author of the new, widely discussed book, The End of Racism. To say that this book is a bombshell is beyond understatement. Many of you have already seen some of the articles in USA Today, in US News, in Newsweek, and Forbes, and so forth. There are a few of them in your packet. The book raises such questions as, is racial prejudice innate, or is it culturally acquired? Is it peculiar to the West, to the United States in particular, or is it found in other societies? What is the legacy of slavery, and do contemporary African Americans, are they owed compensation for it, as well as other groups who faced traumatic racial treatment? Have government affirmative action programs helped or harmed minority groups, as well as the general public? Has the civil rights movement succeeded or failed to overcome the legacy of segregation and Jim Crow and other forms of racism? Can persons of color be racist? Is racism the most serious problem facing minorities, including Black Americans today? And if not, what is? In his book, Dinesh chronicles the political, cultural, and intellectual history of racism. He does it in a way that few have dared to try before. Do current government policies intended to combat the harm that racism actually help, or do they instead perpetuate a cycle of impoverishment and dependency, and hence racial stigmatization? His book chronicles the history of racism, examines the failed policies that have helped spread it, offers a way out of the deadlocked debate about race, and tries to form principles, hopefully, to create a more harmonious, multiracial society. All of these issues revolve around fundamental concepts of what a free and civil society is and how it can be structured. Do we pursue the tradition of Jefferson and Madison and Tocqueville and Hayek, a tradition of equal rights under rule of law where individuals can pursue peaceful lives free of arbitrary coercion from others? Or do we base society on concepts that empower some to forcibly impose their aims on others, and in so doing, cast aside, perhaps, the idea of civil order? Dinesh D'Souza is the John M. Olin Research Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Until his new book, he was best known as the author of the best-selling book, Illiberal Education, The Politics of Race and Sex on Campus. Tom Wolfe praised the book as a bold and controversial work by one of the true, fearlessly iconoclastic writers around today. He's widely regarded for his expertise on race and affirmative action, higher education, social and individual responsibility, and much more, and his articles have appeared seemingly everywhere. He also is a regular interviewee on such programs as Nightline, Firing Line, Crossfire, and many other national TV talk shows. Earlier, he served in the White House as a senior domestic policy analyst, and he graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Dartmouth, where he was the editor of the Dartmouth Review, which in itself is a story to discuss. So without further ado, I want to express my gratitude to have Dinesh D'Souza here and hope that you will welcome him with me.
Thank you very much. I'm very grateful for this opportunity to address such a distinguished audience, and I appreciate that introduction. I remember when I was a White House policy analyst and gave briefings before various groups, I was once introduced by someone who said, "And now, ladies and gentlemen, for the latest dope from the White House," pointed to me. My last book, Illiberal Education, was about the politics of race and gender on campus. I've decided to stop writing about gender, at least for the meantime. And the reason is one that was stated by President Gerald Ford some years ago. He said that there will never be a war between the sexes because there has been too much fraternizing with the enemy. So gender doesn't have the same possibilities for social balkanization, for division, as does race. A subject that has not only intruded upon our public culture, our public policy, we see it in the debate about affirmative action, but also in our popular culture. we see a mental gap that is very evident in the reaction to the Simpson verdict, for example. And what I'd like to do is to try to step back and analyze how we came to this pass, why race relations have seemingly deteriorated to this point, and ask what can we really do about it. It seems to me that we are facing in America a conflict between two principles that are both very important in a multiracial society. The first principle is equality of rights for individuals. And it's the principle that Martin Luther King articulated when he said we should be judged on our merits as individuals by the content of our character, if you will, rather than by our skin color. I assume that most people in this room would agree that this is a very important and a fundamentally American principle. But there is another principle that is also important and one that we can't be indifferent to, and that is equality of results for groups. Now, in a conservative audience, you will find many who say, well, I'm not sure I'm attached to that principle, at least not as enthusiastically. And yet, if we want to live in an inclusive society, a diverse society, in which some groups are not permanently ensconced at the top, and other groups are not permanently consigned to the bottom, in short, if we want to avert a racial caste society, then we cannot be totally indifferent to how groups, as groups, end up. We have to pay some attention to equality of rights for groups as well. And I think one of the problems is that equality of rights for individuals does not lead to equality of results for groups. This was illustrated not very long ago. You remember the regents of the University of California got together to outlaw racial preferences. And this generated an enormous uproar, an enormous controversy. And one reason it engendered such an uproar is because many studies have shown that if the University of California at Berkeley were to admit students solely based upon merit, solely based upon grades and test scores, and nothing else, virtually the entire campus would be made up of two groups, whites and Asians. Over 90% of the Berkeley campus would be composed of these two groups, and the percentage of African Americans of blacks at Berkeley would plummet to between 0.5% and 2%. Now, Berkeley, as you know, is a state university, and the deans, the admissions officers would be acutely embarrassed by a meritocratic admissions policy that produced such racially disparate outcomes. And so Berkeley has done what many other colleges have done, which is try to balance equality of rights for individuals with equality of results for groups. And it has done so by articulating a doctrine called proportional representation. Berkeley would like to have, as you know, a student body that roughly approximates the racial breakdown of the surrounding population. This, of course, is hardly a policy unique to universities. Proportional representation is indeed the fundamental premise of American civil rights laws. If you have a company here in the San Francisco area or in Washington, D.C., and you are sued for discrimination, the federal government, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, will come to your door and say, look, why is it the case that you have only 3% of Hispanics on your payroll when Hispanics are 8% in the surrounding population or in the relevant population? In other words, you are presumed to be guilty of illegal discrimination. Why? Because the assumption of our laws and our policy is that if you were not discriminating, then Hispanics who are 8% in the surrounding population would indeed be roughly 8% at your company as well. And I'd like to step back for a moment and ask an interesting question. Where does this strange assumption come from? Where does the expectation of proportional representation derive from? Historically, proportional representation developed as a logical expression of the philosophy of cultural relativism. Cultural relativism is an academic, a pointy-headed term for a simple idea. By it, I mean nothing more than this. All cultures are basically equal. No culture is superior or inferior, better or worse, than any other. This notion of cultural relativism developed in the early part of this century in order to combat the old racism. The old racism was based upon a doctrine of human hierarchy. The old racist basically said, look, all human beings pass through three stages. savagery, barbarism, and civilization. And they argued that, in effect, only whites are suited, are capable of civilization, and all other groups are consigned to some lower rung on this civilizational ladder, stuck somewhere between barbarism and complete savagery. And this old racism, which was a very unique and novel development in the history of the world, arose, I argue, to explain a large gap of material and technological and civilizational development between the West and the rest of the world. If you lived in the ancient world, in the year 1500, for example, you would see many cultures, many civilizations. Perhaps the most advanced civilization of the time was the Chinese, most advanced in learning, in exploration, in technological development, and so on. Perhaps the second most advanced civilization of the time was the Arab Islamic civilization. But something very interesting happened starting in the year 1500 and culminating in the 19th century, which is that one civilization, that of Europe, which was by no means the most advanced culture in the world before that, began to advance rapidly, began to grow economically, politically, militarily, technologically, advance in learning and discovery, so that it was able to map and plot and explore and subdue the other cultures of the world taken together. So that 100 years ago, for example, European civilization controlled about 90% of the real estate on this planet. Racism became a way to account for this large gap of civilizational development that could not reasonably be attributed to climate or to circumstances or to rivers and so on. And in the 20th century, this old racism came under fierce assault, came under fierce criticism. It came under criticism in the name of cultural relativism. What the cultural relativists said was this. They said, you cannot rank human cultures as superior or inferior, better or worse, more advanced or less advanced. They said every culture is unique. They said every culture is an adaptation to its own particular circumstances, to its own distinct environment. They said that each culture should be respected and studied on its own terms. They said that the right attitude towards cultures is tolerance rather than condescension. They said, in effect, that people should learn to recognize that all cultures are equally entitled to respect. All cultures are basically equal. This was relativism. And a tremendous battle, a debate erupted between the old racists and the new relativists in the early part of this century. It was a debate that was only settled by a single event, World War II. It was Hitler who discredited the old racism. He discredited it not by proving it false, by proving that human beings do not pass through stages of barbarism and civilization. He discredited it by showing that it could have genocidal consequences. So that after World War II, if anyone went around saying some culture is better or worse, or some people are more or superior or inferior, this was regarded as the kind of thinking that led to the gas chambers. In short, after World War II, cultural relativism established itself as the only ethical alternative to genocide. I tell you this because cultural relativism formed the ferment, the soil, out of which the civil rights movement grew. It formed not the conclusions or the arguments of the civil rights movement, but it set up its basic assumption. The basic assumption was as follows. The activists who led the civil rights movement, foremost among them Martin Luther King, believed the following. Because cultures are basically equal, because groups are basically equal in their ability, equal in their talent, equal in their potential, therefore, equality of rights for individuals should lead to equality of results for groups. In other words, because racism has historically been a system of enforced group inequality, by outlawing racism, by making racial discrimination illegal, we expect to find, at least within a reasonably short period of time, something approximating group equality. This was the cardinal assumption of the civil rights movement. And I argue in this book that it is this assumption that equality of rights for individuals will lead to equality of results for groups that has been proven false. What we know a generation later, what we know today, is that merit, no less than the old racism, produces inequality. Merit produces inequality between individuals, I think we all know that, but merit also produces inequality between groups. And this has led a lot of serious people, a lot of civil rights activists, a lot of scholars to believe that merit is the disguised form in which the old racism today expresses itself. So you have a lot of people who say, well, merit, the old racism has not abated, it has not changed, it has sort of gone underground, where it now expresses itself in the form of structures. Well, what structures? Admissions requirements, promotion requirements, hiring strategies, promotion strategies, and so on. Low bid contracts. These meritocratic techniques, which were essentially set into place to fight the old nepotism, these meritocratic systems are now themselves under indictment or under suspicion as being forms in which contemporary racism manifests itself. We then need to ask, is this in fact true? What is the real obstacle, for example, to African Americans as a group getting into Berkeley? Is it that there are raving bigots in the Berkeley admissions office? No. No, if that were the problem, you could just assign every applicant to the university a number, the way you do when you have to take a standardized test. That's not the problem. The problem is that when Berkeley uses selective admissions criteria, not all groups score equally on those criteria to get into the selective university. So the obstacle is Berkeley's demanding admissions requirements. Now, part of the problem is this. For a long time, a lot of well-meaning activists, a lot of well-meaning scholars have contented themselves by saying, well, look, the problem is really not with merit. It is with the way in which these meritocratic systems have been applied. For example, look at the test. A scholastic aptitude test is manifestly biased, racially biased, and biased perhaps along gender and class and other lines as well. And these activists will point to examples from the test where students are asked to find synonyms or antonyms for words like sonnet and sonata. And the assumption is that if you were raised in the suburbs, you know what these terms are. But if you were raised in the inner city, you don't. And there's some truth to that. But look, forget about that. Throw out the verbal section of the test. Look only at the math section. Will anyone in this room tell me with a straight face that equations are racially biased or algebra is rigged against Hispanics? This is preposterous. And yet the same racial gaps that we see on the verbal section of the test are year after year equal or exceeded in the math section. In fact, one of the most telling statistics in the book, based on data from the College Board, year after year, says that whites and Asians who come from families making less than $20,000 a year score higher on the math section of the test every year than African Americans coming from families making over $60,000 a year. Why is this? Because I think it's pointing to a larger problem. And the larger problem is that we want to live in a multiracial society in which groups are equal but only different. If that were the society we lived in, we could have multiculturalism. Let's just celebrate our differences. The problem, as I see it, is we are evolving, we are developing into a society which really mirrors a certain kind of racial or ethnic hierarchy. Asians and whites at the top, Hispanics in the middle, African Americans at the bottom. This is a very distressing reality. And it is a reality that cannot be blamed on bias in the test. So what is going on? The basic argument of my book is that what we have here is a problem not of genes and not of discrimination, but what we have is a problem of culture. What we have is an American cultural decline, an American cultural breakdown, but one whose effects are particularly harsh, are particularly severe when it comes to African Americans and especially poor blacks. There's a lot of literature on the subject which I discuss with great care in the book. But for example, I point out that in the inner city, for example, we have a culture that is very sadly characterized by the following elements, or some of the following elements. A kind of reflexive paranoia about racism. A belief, for example, that AIDS is a government-sponsored plot. Within certain sectors, a hostility to academic achievement, which is sometimes decried as a form of acting white. In fact, there's such a stigma to doing well in class that there are schools in Washington, D.C., which are overwhelmingly black, in which prizes at the end of the year, prize ceremonies for smart kids, are conducted in secret, because if you had them in public, no one would show up. Third, a heavy reliance on the government, which is seen as the primary source of jobs, of provision, of social support. So a reliance on the government for help and for support. Fourth, the rise of very high rates of violence, violence that makes some communities in our country virtually uninhabitable, make it difficult for people to get out of their homes, make businesses flee, make other places boarded up, make the community a very dangerous place to live, resulting not only in white flight, but also in black flight. And finally, the epidemic of illegitimacy, the normalization of illegitimacy, which might even be one of the driving forces pushing this entire engine. These problems, I emphasize, are not due to natural or genetic factors, and they are not due to racism. I think I can prove this definitively by the following example. When we talk, for example, about illegitimacy rates, and I emphasize this is a national problem. Illegitimacy rates for whites are now approximately where they were for blacks when Moynihan wrote his famous or infamous report in The Black Family not long ago. But the breakdown of the black family, a much discussed problem, is often by many serious people who should know better. Say, they will tell you very confidently, oh, that's due to slavery. And they say, look at those slave owners. Marriage was not legal under slavery. Slave owners broke up families, sold off children, and so on, which is all true. But the problem is that in 1910, W.E.B. Du Bois did a study of the subject, and he found that the illegitimacy rate for blacks in America, 30 years after slavery was ended, was about 20%, higher than the white rate, which was about 2%, but vastly, vastly lower than the current rate, which is close to 70%. So the current problems of the black family cannot in the main, or for the most part, be attributed to slavery. In fact, the black family was actually relatively intact and in good shape, in strong shape. Blacks made a fantastic and a heroic effort to rebuild their families after slavery. And it was only starting around 1960 that illegitimacy rates began to climb and reach their currently astronomical levels in the 80s and early 90s. Now, a generation ago, as I say, the gene pool for all groups, I mean, especially for blacks, was about the same as it is now. Obviously, genes are not involved. Obviously, intrinsic factors can be dismissed. And also, a generation ago, racism was a lot worse. Racism was a lot worse then. It was a lot more overt, state-sponsored. It often had the backing of not only law, but also of custom. So what I think we have to attribute these problems to culture. Now, let me explain what I mean by culture. What I mean by culture is that groups can develop an oppositional culture that represents a sensible and intelligent adaptation to historical circumstances, and yet one that is in some ways today a liability. I'll give an example from my own country. When my parents were growing up in India, the Indians developed a culture of protest, which can be summarized by the following phrase: lie down on the railway tracks. It was the heyday of British colonialism, for example. And in my parents' generation, what the Indians would do to send the British home is they just go down, lie down on the railway tracks. They knew that the British were not like Hitler. They wouldn't keep the trains going. But they would stop the trains, and this would stop the empire. And it did. It did. A generation later, in the 1990s, I go home to visit my family every 2 years or so. I was down in March, go down to the Bombay Railway Station. Sure enough, there are 10 guys lying on the railway tracks. So you say, what are you doing? And they say, well, see, we work at this factory down the street, and we want a 9% pay raise. They only want to give us 4. And so we've decided to express our discontent by putting on these Gandhian robes and making our voices known. And the police and the politicians are immobilized. No one will pick these guys off the railway tracks because they are the true Gandhians. And my point is simply this: a culture that made sense, and a cultural orientation that made sense a generation ago, is an obstacle, is dysfunctional today. Let me give an example more specific to America, and it has to do with attitudes toward the government. More than any other group, African Americans are sympathetic to the government, look to the government as an important source of jobs, of rights, of education, and so on. Historically, many whites have viewed the government as the enemy of rights. If you look at the Founding Fathers' debates, and the Bill of Rights says, Congress shall not do this, Congress shall not do that. Limitations on the government are regarded as the crucial way to protect the citizens' freedom and security. Well, for blacks, historical experience has proved the opposite. It was the federal government that ended slavery. It was the federal government that ended segregation. It was the federal government that was an employer of last resort for many blacks in this century. So it's not all that surprising that as a group, blacks tend to see the government more sympathetically than most other groups. And all I'm trying to say is that this cultural orientation, which made a lot of sense at one time, is today a liability. And why is it a liability? Because the record of the government in solving problems has been nixed to abysmal, because the government no longer has the resources anymore, because public confidence in the government in this democratic society is at an all-time low. And so you have a lot of guys marching on Washington all the time, the Million Man March, the anniversary of the Martin Luther King March. And I've been to all these marches, and they'll say, you know, we got to go to Bill Clinton and ask for 300,000 new jobs. Well, you know, I work in the White House. Bill Clinton does not have 300,000 new jobs. He has about 300 jobs, and most of them are taken. So that the orientation that looks to government is today not that effective. Meanwhile, other ethnic groups, and it's not any particular, it's the Cubans, it's the West Indians, it's the Koreans, are setting up in the inner city, setting up rotating credit associations, and within a generation, their daughters are valedictorians, they have moved to the suburbs. These cultural strategies are crucial. I quote the urban anthropologist Elijah Anderson, who discusses what he calls the two cultures of the inner city. A black culture of decency, characterized by millions of people who struggle to maintain intact families, get to work, live in safe neighborhoods, the majority of people. And on the other hand, what he calls a culture of irresponsibility, a culture characterized by drugs, by crime, by violence, by sex abuse, by illegitimacy, and so on. Who can deny that that culture also exists and that it is also real? And this brings me to my main point, which is that we are now in a liberal dilemma. And this is the liberal dilemma. Cultural relativism, which has historically been a very effective weapon for toppling the old racism, for destabilizing the old racist hierarchy, this cultural relativism is now a millstone around our necks, because it makes it impossible for us to proclaim as a society that some cultures are simply better than others. It makes it difficult as a society to say that we are going to encourage and strengthen, both as a matter of public policy and civic duty, cultures of decency, and we are going to work to undermine cultures of irresponsibility. So relativism, once adaptive itself, is now maladaptive. And I argue that we should get rid of relativism. Forget it. The old racists maintained that you could rank cultures hierarchically, and that this ranking was due to biology. Liberalism has been based on denying A. You can't rank cultures hierarchically. All cultures are equal. I'm saying we should admit A, but deny B. We should admit that in a functional sense, yes, obviously some cultures are better than others, better at getting certain things done. But this is not due to biology. There's nothing about our innate characteristics, about the content of our chromosomes, that makes us act in a certain way. Of course not. I think what we need is twofold. We need a colorblind public policy, what I call separation of race and state. Get the government out of the race business and stop playing favorites with citizens. And on the other side, we need a cultural strategy that is spearheaded by the private sector, but that is also spearheaded with leadership within the black community. And this cultural strategy is aimed at raising the cultural standards of all Americans, but also with particular benefits for African Americans, so that African Americans can compete effectively with other groups. I've been criticized by a couple of black conservatives who say, in effect, look, we agree with you on point one. You're right about affirmative action. That's gone too far, etc. But we don't think you should be talking about culture, especially about African-American culture. That's a very unpleasant subject. Let's not talk about that. But here's the problem. If conservatives embrace the colorblind society but pay no attention to culture, we will find ourselves in a tremendous trap. The trap is this. Equality of rights for individuals would immediately lead to dramatic inequality of results for groups. I don't think most of us in this room want to live in a society. I don't think most of us in this room want to have a Berkeley campus where there are virtually no blacks, or an MIT where there are virtually no blacks, or certain professions where blacks become very scarce. A strict commitment to color blindness would begin to produce this inequality, not just on account of the old racism, but also on account of merit. I am fully convinced that blacks can compete effectively with other groups. In this sense, my book, I think, is a tough book, because it faces painful realities. Tom Sowell, who's compared the book to Gunnar Myrdal's American Dilemma, says that The End of Racism is a heartbreaking book because the truth is heartbreaking. But only if you face up to it can you begin to address these problems. I think if we have this two-step strategy, it will allow conservatives who have been on the weak end of the race debate, having a very poor record of supporting many of the civil rights initiatives that blacks have come to depend on, and other groups too, those of us who are persons of color, we have benefited too. No question about it. I think it's time for conservatives to take the leadership in the race debate, and the way to do it is to propose a strategy that offers some hope for working. If our problems are in our genes, there's nothing we can do about them. We are condemned to fatalism. If the problems of blacks or any other group are due to white racism, we are also condemned to fatalism for the following reason. I don't know of any new ways to fight white racism that are going to improve black test scores, increase black savings rates, increase black rates of business formation, strengthen black families, reduce black-on-black crime. These problems are due to the historic legacy of racism, but they have taken on a cultural life of their own. And I'm simply arguing that as a society, in a compassionate way, these problems should be tackled head-on. I don't claim to know all the answers. There are certain weaknesses to writing a book when you are something of an outsider. I was not born in this country. I was not raised through the civil rights movement. And there are some weaknesses that go with that. But there are some strengths as well. Because I find a lot of Americans, black and white, are very neurotic on the subject of race. And people who have fought through the civil rights movement are captive to that old ideology. They cannot see ways in which the world has changed. And I'm sure if we brought Alexander Solzhenitsyn into this room and asked him, what do you think is the most serious problem facing Russia? He would say, maybe, the return of the Bolsheviks. And we would all understand why he would say that, given his life experience. But he would be wrong. He would be wrong. And so the fact is, I see my book as a response to the fact that our current paradigm, our current way of thinking about race, our current policies to deal with it, have made important gains, but are now at a dead end. We now have more polarization than ever. We live in a more racially intoxicated society. King's dream of a colorblind society seems more distant than ever. For this reason, I think we need less political correctness, more of a willingness to turn assumptions into questions, to ask questions that were not asked and didn't need to be asked 5 or 10 or 20 years ago. It's that project that I undertake in this book, and that's why I urge you to read it. Thank you very much.